Hey, it's Dr. Gerber with another psychological podcast, and today's podcast is going to be a discussion with Dr. Michael Zentman, and I'll get to his background in a second, but let me give you the history on the situation. Dr. Zentman is a psychologist who practices on Long Island in Manhattan, and he listened to one of my earlier podcasts, which was the presentation of the three types of psychotherapy. Now, Dr. Zentman is a psychoanalyst. I'm a cognitive behaviorist, and I believe Dr. Zentman thought I kind of shortchanged psychoanalysis and didn't give an adequate description, so I invited him on the show. And before he comes on, let me give you a little background about Dr. Zentman. I told you that he's a practicing clinical psychologist for the last 27 years in Centerport, Long Island, in Manhattan. In addition to his doctoral degree in clinical psychology, he completed 8 additional years of postdoctoral training in psychoanalysis and psychotherapy, group therapy, and family and marital therapy. He's taught at the graduate and postdoctoral level for 18 years. He's on the faculty of the Training Institute for Mental Health in Manhattan, and he is an associate clinical professor of psychology and supervisor of psychotherapy and psychoanalysis at Adelphi University in Garden City, New York. He is the founder and director of the Adelphi University Postgraduate Program in Marriage and Couple Therapy. In addition to working with families and couples, Dr. Zentman has consulted with many family business owners on the complex interaction of their businesses and their families. So, Dr. Zentman, I understand that I've glossed over psychoanalysis and maybe not explained to the listening audience the full details of what contemporary psychoanalysis is. So, thank you for coming on the show to explain.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you having me on and giving me a chance to talk about the other perspective on this.
Great. So, what is contemporary psychoanalysis, and how is it different from what everyone perceives psychoanalysis to be?
Okay. Well, your depiction of it isn't unusual, because that's sort of the television and the film view of what psychoanalysis is, the old Freudian analysis with the couch and the patient talking continuously and the analyst not saying a word for several months at a time.
Right.
That was a way that people worked. It was the way Freud originally conceptualized psychoanalysis, where he looked at what's going on inside the person, their wishes, their desires, their fantasies, all the unconscious process. Mm-hmm. And everything focused on the inside of that person. Contemporary psychoanalysis has really expanded the view. If you think of it as a wide-angle lens now, instead of a narrow telephoto, and that we look at not just what's going on in the person, but what's going on between people.
Uh-huh.
And we believe that we're less driven by desires and urges and impulses as much as we are by the requirements of interpersonal contact.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a significant difference from the traditional or classical psychoanalysis.
So are contemporary psychoanalysts more involved in the therapy process and more vocal?
That's perfect. Involved and vocal exactly describes it.
Mm-hmm.
There's much more involvement and much more participation in the session, and interaction in the session.
So I remember an old Woody Allen movie where he said he was in psychotherapy for 15 years.
I thought it was 21. I think it was bananas. He woke up out of this coma, and he said it was 21 years later. He said, I could have been done by now.
Oh, no, actually, that was Sleeper. That was Sleeper.
Oh, you're right. That was Sleeper. Absolutely.
Yeah, right.
Yep. Right.
So that's kind of like the old world. Once you're in psychoanalysis,
never get out.
Right, you never get out.
Right. Well, let me speak to that. The length of any therapy is usually related to the ambitiousness of the therapy goal. If somebody comes into psychoanalysis and they want to really focus on a specific issue, a relationship issue, it's not going to take them 15 years. It probably will take 2 or 3 years of intensive work. But if somebody really sort of looks at analysis like some people look at going to the gym as an ongoing experience that they wish to sort of incorporate in their lives, people do stay in for a long time, but they don't have to necessarily.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So with the advent of managed care, kind of putting limitations and restrictions on how long people can go, is that kind of helped some of this modification?
As far as making it briefer?
Yeah.
Well, not necessarily. There have been brief forms of psychoanalysis, psychoanalytic work, for many years now. There's brief relational therapy, brief psychodynamic therapy, time-limited dynamic therapy. They have been around for, to my knowledge, over 25, 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
Managed care, I guess, made those a bit more appealing, but there have been briefer forms of psychoanalytic work available to the public.
Ah, okay. Unfortunately, my phone's ringing here, so I'm trying to get away from it as much as I can.
Yeah, I heard.
I read an article that psychoanalysts at least are doing research with using brainwave machinery, mapping brains, trying to figure out where the psychoanalyst works and what kind of changes are made. Have you heard of that?
I've heard of it. I'm not deeply involved in it. Alan Shore and his group have done a lot of work on neuropsychology and brainwave. And interestingly enough, they're finding correlations between the treatment and the effect on the brain and on the person's functioning in their lives. So they're beginning to find empirical evidence to support the value of psychoanalytic work.
Mm-hmm.
For certain kinds of problems, not others. I mean, I fully agree with you, and I think you may have mentioned this in your earlier podcast, that if somebody comes for a panic disorder or other phobias, psychoanalysis is not necessarily the treatment of choice.
Mm-hmm.
It has its realm of usefulness, and it's not in these kinds of very focused, symptom-based issues.
So what would be an ideal or a much more appropriate patient situation for psychoanalysis?
I think analysis today deals best with relationship problems, because what happens is that the relationship between the patient and the analyst become like a little social laboratory, and it is within that relationship that they explore what relationship difficulties the patient is having.
Mm-hmm.
So if the patient tends to tune people out, that's going to happen in the session, and the analyst will be able to say, I feel like I just said something and you're not even here. It's like you left the room.
Right.
And so the relationship becomes very much the place where the work is done, which is, again, where things are very different today from Freudian analysts, where the relationship was not the focus. And so I guess relationship issues are probably the best type of problems that you can work on as an analyst.
Psychoanalytic training is generally over and above graduate training.
Yes.
How does that work?
Well, once you have your end degree, whether it's an MSW or a PhD or an RN, whatever, you traditionally go to a psychoanalytic institute, and that involves a total of like 4 to 10 years of additional training, which includes coursework, usually about 4 years worth of coursework, supervision of your cases, you're seeing a certain number of patients, and then your own analysis. And
mm-hmm.
So it's a fairly intensive process to go through. And then there's a final paper or an article that you have to write to complete it.
Mm-hmm. If someone was seeking psychoanalysis, how would they find a psychoanalyst in their area? What would they do? What kind of research would they have to go through?
That's a good question. I guess probably one way would be to contact a psychoanalytic institute mm-hmm. in their area. Certainly here in the New York area, there are a lot of institutes, and they could give them a name.
Mm-hmm.
And there are the American Psychological Association has a division for psychoanalysis, so they could contact the American Psychological Association, get to the division of psychoanalysis, and then find local people. And I imagine other professions, social work has some similar bodies and organizations to check with.
My audience, it appears, is pretty worldwide. So I have a tremendous number of listeners in Australia, Asia, and Europe. So are there international organizations, or are there other ways that people who...
Yes, there is an international psychoanalytic organization, and that would be, that's a good point. That would be another venue for them to check with. I think it's called the International Psychoanalytic Society, although I can't swear to that. They probably should Google international and psychoanalysis, and they'll come up with an answer.
That's great.
But there are many, many places in the world and many places in the United States where you really cannot find an analyst. They probably tend to be around more metropolitan areas where they get the training.
And I heard that the New York vicinity has 7% of the total United States population, but 25% of the psychiatrists.
Okay. What does that mean, doctor?
Well, I think it goes back to, you know, your statement that, you know, in the cosmopolitan, you know, the big areas, it's easy to find treatment. But when you're in, you know, Wyoming or, you know, Monkey Falls, Minnesota or something, you know, it's a tougher call to get treatment.
Yeah. But there's another thing that I should mention, that there is something called psychodynamic therapy, which is not as intensive and as lengthy as traditional psychoanalysis, but uses similar theories and is a little different in technique. And there are many more psychodynamic-oriented therapists than there are psychoanalysts. And, you know, probably most psychoanalysts practice a good deal of psychodynamic therapy because everybody doesn't want to come in three or four times a week for, you know, the length of time that's required. That's a huge commitment.
Mm-hmm.
So psychodynamic therapy is another approach.
Right. Okay. You're, as I understand it, the founder and director of the postgraduate program in marriage and couple therapy at Adelphi University.
Adelphi University. Yeah.
How's that program going? Is it thriving? Is it growing?
It's thriving. We're just finishing up our third class, which means I guess we've been going for about 7 years now.
Mm-hmm.
2-year program, and we just made a change from taking only people with doctorates to taking people with any licensed mental health degree, our programs have been growing.
Terrific.
Yeah. It's interesting because a lot of clinicians do marital therapy, but very few of us have actually been trained in that.
Right.
All of us have been trained in individual therapy, but there's not much marital therapy training at the graduate level. So most people have to go postgraduate to do that.
Yeah, there wasn't that much training in my program either.
No.
And essentially what happens once you got out there, you had to muddle through it and try to figure out how to take those individual skills and now work on a couple.
You got it. And that works for many couples that are not in a lot of trouble. But if a couple's in a lot of trouble, the individual skills fall short and treatment usually runs into
trouble. Wait, what couple goes to therapy that isn't in a lot of trouble?
Well,
hasn't been my experience.
Well, it's like a car accident. It can just be like a $1,000 repair or a $9,000 repair. If they have to be in enough trouble to show up at your office, but some couples, I guess the difference is a couple that's been having a problem for maybe a couple of years, 2-3 years, and couples who've been battling for, 10, 15, 20 years or the whole duration of the marriage. Those are tougher to work with. They require different skills and techniques.
Yeah, I tend to get referrals from there's a divorce mediation center on Long Island.
Mm-hmm.
And
they
send me their cases when they believe that both parties are not on the same page. It's my job to say, or to get them on the same page. Either you're going to get a divorce or you're going to save your marriage. You can't go in there and say, well, I want to work and I want to leave.
Right.
Those are very tough cases.
Those are very tough cases. Exactly. Each one has a different agenda. It's interesting. And those are the kinds of cases I like to work with. I usually work with couples who are in the most trouble, who've had some prior treatment failures, and for some reason I sort of take to working with that kind of a case. And what you're describing is some of the toughest.
Right. Yep. So those are the ones I see. So I always think when if a couple's in therapy, they're, it's a problem. It would be wiser, I think, if people, you know, had some kind of pre-training before they got married on, on how to resolve issues and conflicts and how to communicate better. But somehow,
not required.
No, no. We spend more time giving people training on how to drive a car.
I was just going to say the same thing. You don't get a driver's license without being trained, but you get a marriage license.
Right.
And having kids, you don't doesn't require any kind of
parent training at all. And I used to do that too. I would run parent training programs, and eventually it faded because nobody was interested in them. And they were pretty, you know, pretty precise, like an 8-session program.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually nobody wanted them.
I know.
And it's I think they should have parent training in junior high school. Just start them there.
You're right. You're right. I agree with you. I think that's a huge gap in our system. Look, if you think about it, who teaches us how to be married? Our parents. Sometimes that's good. Sometimes it's not.
Sometimes it's not.
And, you know, so you're right. There's a great shortage of training.
That's what I tell my clients. I say, you know, the only one who taught you how to be a parent is your parents. Mm-hmm. And you may not have liked all the things they taught you. And, in fact, you may have said, I don't want to do them. But son of a gun, if somewhere down the line, out of your mouth comes one of your mother's lines.
Right, and you said, gee, I sound just like my mother.
Right.
You're right. And it's not so easy to change that. And that, we should probably do a podcast on that someday. I'd love to talk about the whole marital issue.
Oh, great. And unfortunately, we're out of time today.
Okay.
So, Dr. Zeman, I want to thank you, and it was great talking to you. And I want to thank you for clarifying my erroneous statements.
I really appreciate your open-mindedness.
Okay.
By the way, can I say one quick thing?
Sure.
There are Freudians today, contemporary Freudians, who are still Freudian, but they incorporate much more of an interpersonal point of view. And I didn't want to leave that out because
okay.
it would feel like I'm misrepresenting them, as I felt you were misrepresenting analysis.
Okay.
I really appreciate your opening the door for me to discuss this.
Great. I appreciate
okay.
it. Until next time, this is Dr. Howard Gurr. And if you want to see more about me, go to my website at drsgurr.com.